Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. Each year, a team of five distinguished biographers come together to choose the best biography of the year. How do they do it, and what is the process? What's it like to receive this prestigious honor? To answer those questions, I talked not just with the 2024 chair of the Plutarch, but also with the award winner. In February 2025, I recorded my conversation with Bio member Carol Sklenica, who served as committee chair for the 2024 Plutarch Award. She has written two biographies, Alice Adams, Portrait of a Writer, and Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, both published by Scribner. I began my conversation by asking Carol about the Plutarch Award.
The Plutarch Award, named for supposedly the first biographer, I believe he was a Greek, was set up early on with Bio, our organization to support biographers, and it's the only major book award in biography that is selected by a jury of biographers. There are other awards that include biographies, but ours is really special because only biographers really understand how difficult it can be to write one. And so we think we have a great appreciation of what we want to honor in the genre.
Each year, the committee is different, and so is the chair. You were the chair of the 2024 Plutarch Award Committee. How many people are on this committee?
I was the chair, and I had been invited to do that by the president of Bio. That was Linda Level at the time. I'd been asked before and didn't have time, so it's a very, it's a lot of work to be the chair, I think.
How long is the selection process? And then how many times do you meet?
The process takes a year because it's looking at biographies published in English during a particular year. And then you need a little time after the year's over to choose your winners. We met at least once a month, sometimes more often.
How do you whittle down the dozens and dozens of biographies that are published each year to just 10? And then I understand you go from 10 to 5 and then to 1, correct?
Well, first of all, we, at least our committee, tried to get as many entries as we could. Bio members may nominate their own books. They may nominate other books that they've come across or read about. Publishers may nominate. So we had more than 200 books from independent publishers, from the big five publishers, obviously, and also biographies are often published by university presses. So we really had the whole spectrum of kinds of publishers publishing in English. And these books show up in big boxes at your doorstep, beginning, you know, as soon as the committee is formed. You know, we're all book lovers, so I think to some extent, we enjoyed that, but we kind of, the five people that were on in our group kind of each had special interests, so we took it upon ourselves to look at certain books. We had an art historian in our group, and most of us had written about writers, but we had some people with more knowledge of science, so we made sure that every book got a serious look by one of us. And if one of us thought it had potential, we would mention it at our next meeting and ask the others to look. In most cases, I have to say then somebody thought the book wasn't strong enough because there's a lot of winnowing that has to happen. But we were always looking for what's special about each book and trying to see that. There are some stated criteria from Bio, and they are the quality of the research. We didn't look at any books that had no research trail. We looked at them, but we didn't consider them. So we would expect, if not endnotes, some other detailed explanation of the research and where the information came from. The literary merit of the writing, which was very important to all of us. and the originality and significance of the project. That's a nice catch-all term because significance might cover, you know, important political figures, for instance, or major artists who are already well known. But originality allows us to include subjects that you've probably never heard of, but a biographer has done a good job of making that subject significant. And over the years, Bio has recognized a lot of books like that. We had one in my year about a singer named Connie Converse that none of us had heard of, and it ended up being one of our top five, I think.
Yes, that was by Howard Fishman, called To Anyone Who Ever Asks, The Life, Music, and Mystery of Connie Converse. An excellent book.
An amazing book. And that particular one is very much about his quest for the research. So there's a subject we're all discussing about metabiography, whether the biographer includes herself or himself in the book. And that's one that does. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. We thought that one worked.
Some other finalists include Jonathan Eig's book, King, A Life. You guys also chose The Hungry Season by Lisa Hamilton and The Ship by Prudence Pfeiffer. Those were the top five, including the winner, which was Yipoka Yibo's A Nun Sees Gold, her first book. What was it about this book in particular that you all thought should win the Plutarch?
Well, what blew me away about that book from the very first page was the writer's voice. And it's not in a tricky way at all. She doesn't really put herself in the story, but she completely dominates that story with her voice from the first page. In addition, it was a story that was just stunningly unusual to us as American readers. We all happen to be American on this panel. And it's a story about West Africa. And so we just learned a whole lot. I mean, one reason I love biographies is I'm learning about things in the world that haven't come to me in any other way. So probably didn't hurt that it was her first book and it was so impressive. Jonathan Eig's King was certainly a close competitor. It's an amazing book. We all thought it was absolutely perfect. I don't know if I should say this, but it seemed to us that that book was inevitably going to get a lot of attention, and we were happy to bring more attention to Anansi's Gold. The other three, by the way, it's The Slip, not The Ship.
Yes, it is The Slip. It's not The Ship, and I'm looking at my sloppy handwriting. Yes, thank you for that.
The Slip impressed us again for its originality. It's about a group of artists, some of whom are not even that well known, at least to non-art historians. Robert Indiana and some other artists in the, I think it was the 1950s, in a place in New York called Cowente's Slip, a dead-end street near the water, where people lived in warehouses and had their art careers. It's a group biography. That's certainly a part of the way people are writing biographies now that we wanted to recognize, and we thought that one worked very well. It's also difficult because it's like writing five or six biographies in one book, and the amount of research is different, although it's focused on a certain part of their lives. The Hungry Season was one that I championed because it was an incredible research into a Hmong woman who did not speak English, her life in the Central Valley of California, growing rice and sending support to her family in Laos and Thailand. The author, Lisa Hamilton, I mean, it was just amazing. She even traveled to Thailand and Laos with her subject. Ia was her first name. Ia Mua, really a biography of that woman, but it's also a story of people and a time in Southeast Asia and immigration to this country and what they went through. Well, we had a spreadsheet. We each had our favorites. We gave rankings just to guide us. We were flexible about changing them and 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 at our meetings, we tried to convince each other to like the books that we liked. So ultimately, I think we voted. We were all unanimous, I know, in the choice of Anansi's Gold for the Plutarch Award. And I believe we all were in favor of every book on the list of 10, on the long list of 10. Within that, we had our favorites too. I'd like people interested in biography to know that I work as a coach for new biographers. I'm one of Bio's people in the coaching program, and I love doing that. It's a group of experienced biographers who are available to do private coaching with, well, anyone, but particularly people who are writing their first biography find it helpful. Bio will hook you up with one of us. You don't have to do it yourself. You can contact the president of Bio or someone on the committees, and they will connect you with someone. I believe there's a one free session available to every member. And then if they want to hire us privately, we continue to work with that person. I find it fascinating because I'm not writing another biography myself right now, but I love helping other people do it.
What are some other ways that you're involved with bio?
I can't travel these days. And well, since the pandemic, travel's been difficult, but for other reasons, it's still difficult for us. So I attend everything on Zoom. And one good thing about the pandemic was the invention of Zoom. I mean, I feel like people all over the country are really active in bio now without having to go to the conference. But the main benefit of bio for anyone is the networking and the conversations. If you run into a problem in your research, there'll be somebody that you can write to through one of our Facebook groups or some other way. There are workshop groups. There are lots of ways you can access help through bio. On the other hand, biography, I mean, I think we ought to just have fans of biography too. We need more readers. And biography is a window into history, which we certainly need right now.
Yes, we do.
One thing we did look for in our awards was the rigor of research. You've got to be careful. We had books that were appealing in some ways, but verged into fiction, and we passed on them. And that's something for people to be aware of if they're serious about writing what we would consider biographies. And there are lots of ways to speculate in a biography, but you need to be transparent that that's what you're doing. That's what our committee concluded anyway.
That was my conversation with Carol Sklenica talking with me on Zoom about her role as committee chair for the 2024 Plutarch Award, as well as her role as a biography coach. To work with Carol or other biographers here at Bio, visit our website, biographersinternational.org, and click on the Members Resources tab to sign up. Bio coaches are well-versed in pitch letters, book proposals, and so much more. Next up is a conversation I had in February 2025 with the winner of the Plutarch. Ipoka Yebo's book, Anansi's Gold, The Man Who Looted the West, Outfoxed Washington, and Swindled the World, was published by Bloomsbury in August 2023. This is her first biography. I began our conversation by asking her about John Aka Blay Meza, the subject of Anansi's Gold.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to speak. John Aka Blay Meza was the charming, brilliant architect of a massive scam that got like untold millions out of people all over the world, in the US, in the UK, in Ghana, as far out as South Korea. And he did this by telling everybody that he was the heir to a secret fortune hidden away by Kwame Nkrumah, the first leader of Ghana.
Yeah, and you write that history is a fragile thing. Talk to me about the history of Ghana and his involvement or lack thereof.
It's a really, really fiddly thing. Obviously, independence was a complex thing, and countries in Africa becoming independent obviously like challenged the imperial order. And Kwame Nkrumah especially was very good at playing the West, the Brits and the Americans against the East, Russia and Germany and China. This made him remarkably unpopular. He was also on the sly, like supporting, funding, training other independence movements in Africa. In 1966, he's unseated in a coup, and immediately the coup makers, but also the foreign press, start telling stories about why he was unseated, that he had stolen away millions. He had like gold toilets and gold taps and a girlfriend in every African capital and a mansion in every African capital and like gigantic American sports cars, all while the Ghanaian economy floundered. In Ghana, a bunch of former government ministers were trotted out to like give press conferences to attest to this. The vast majority were trotted out from prison where they had been put for corruption. So they weren't super reliable sources of this information. It didn't matter that there was no evidence that Kwame Nkrumah was crooked or had any of this. This is what fueled Blame Aza's stories and the scams. It became common knowledge that Nkrumah somehow had hidden millions away somewhere. And at one point, Nkrumah's daughter told me that she was in school in a lesson, and they were just going through like Ghana's history day by day, and they got to the 60s and her teacher was like, and then Ghana lost all the money because your father took it all. That's how common the story became. And so it was very, very easy for someone to come in and say, I actually know where all this money is. And if you help me get it by giving me a little money or helping me talk to the right people, I can give you a 10 to 1 return on your investment or 100 to 1 return on your investment. That's like, the story was that there was so much money that he could return the bulk of it to Ghana and still have like interest to give to people who invested in this. And if you were, for example, as several of his investors were, living in Philly, and you heard the story, you may have heard like rumblings of this in the news. And if you went to the library and pulled up stories about Ghana, you would just see the stories about like the girlfriends, the mansions, the gold taps, and it would seem legit that somebody could find this money.
How did you come across his name and decide that there's a biography here?
My mom sent me a WhatsApp message. And it was a clip of a 16-minute segment about Blame Aza, and it was like ridiculous. He was like sitting on a gold Louis Cannes chair in this like palatial mansion and unspooling this story. And at the same time, Ed Bradley was like undoing the story. The key part of it was that Blame Aza was at Kwame Nkrumah's bedside when he died in Romania in 1972. And then it cut to like Bradley in front of a Graterford State Prison in Pennsylvania, saying this is actually where Blame Aza was when Nkrumah died. So it was all very dramatic. And my mom was like, what do you think of the story Blame Aza is telling? And that struck me as like curious, because my mom generally isn't the kind of person to be like, do you think this admitted con man is maybe telling the truth about this? And it's for the same reasons as like Blame Aza was getting away with it, because the story had been told so many times. So that got me interested. And then I finally started like doing some very, very basic, like, who is this man and what the hell was happening research. And one of the first caches of information I found were a bunch of like State Department cables from Shirley Temple Black to Henry Kissinger about him. That was the point at which I was like, yeah, there's.
Why would your mom text you this message? Why was she interested? And why did she think that you would be interested?
I like am a fact checker for my mom. WhatsApp, especially among like the aunties and uncles, is like diasporic communities, is main source of information, but it's also just full of absolute crap, just the worst kind of misinformation. And my mom's in like a million different community groups and friend groups and things like that, and so occasionally she'll send me something from one of those and be like, what do you think about this? So the 60 Minutes clip was going around because it was like an election year in Ghana, and they were talking about precedent for people being thrown off the ballot, and Blame Aza ran for president in 1979 as part of this incredibly elaborate scheme and was thrown off the ballot. And so I think this clip was being rebroadcast in Ghana and people were debating his story all over again. And so that's why she sent it to me. I think also because we talked about this, like, I think she'd probably heard these stories since she was a child. Like, Ghana is a wealthy country. It is really rich in minerals. It's a wonderful place to grow things. So why on earth is it really poor? And one of the reasons people commonly repeated was that Kwame Nkrumah either frittered all the money away, stole it. And I think that's what she wanted to talk about.
When you decided to write this biography, where did you begin your research?
I went to the British Library and I started pulling like newspapers, and any like secondary stuff I could find from the era. Problem was that a lot of the stuff I was looking for was just not there. There was actually very little secondary stuff I could read on, like, and I'm talking like very basic stuff. Like I was just looking for biographical stuff on Ghanaian leaders, and there wasn't a whole lot there, and there certainly wasn't much. There basically wasn't anything on John Akabwe Mazer or the Omar Ghana Trust Fund. And so it like really rapidly became clear that I would have to find primary sources for pretty much everything, which is not something I anticipated. But that ended up being a great deal of fun. It was sort of like a treasure hunt with papers and with just trying to feel out the context I was writing in. And then I ended up building a timeline using newspaper clips and the news coverage I could find, which was pretty healthy. Like after the British Library, I had a bunch of trips to Philly where I could do things like go to Temple University, where they have the morgue of the Philadelphia Evening News. Incredible collection, but it was literally like the boxes full of like clipped out bits of newspaper, but then you look at the date and it was like 1926 and it was crumbly. So from Ghanaian papers and Philly papers, I got like a rough timeline of everything that had happened that I could also hang like the State Department cables and like diplomatic communiques on. And that's where I got the first sense of like beginning, middle, end, and then it like ends roughly around the time of the 60 Minutes clip I saw.
And what archives did you end up visiting by the end of your research? I'm sure you visited at least a dozen, but what were some of the highlights of your research process?
Temple University's archive, incredible. The Morgue of the Evening News. They have like the really, really fascinating archive of like Philadelphia itself. So there were like great pictures in there, and there was a lot of material there I could use. But I randomly ran into someone who had done a whole bunch of research, like a professor at Temple University named Lyndon Washington, who had also researched the Omar Ghana Trust Fund. And so he had a personal archive. Ended up actually leaning a lot on people's personal archives, like former security agents who kept some of the like material they had used. There were people who just had piles of clips in suitcases at home that ended up being really useful. I enjoyed thoroughly going to the county clerk's office in Philadelphia to pull court papers. I didn't think when I went, and it should have been obvious to me that they probably wouldn't have been digitized. And so when I went there, they were like, obviously, we have to go and pull this from the stacks. And then when they did pull them from the stacks, it was like a pile this high. But then because I was like standing there photocopying gigantic heaps of paper, I got to watch just people come in and out, characters on characters on characters. Like it was also the first time I'd seen a bounty hunter that actually looked like Dog the Bounty Hunter in real life. It was a woman who had like the full 80s mullet and the muscle shirt and the leather pants. And I was like, I just want to be near you and to love what you do. I mean, heavily on the British Library, because that's what's closest to me and has like a reliable pile of Ghanaian newspapers. And then the pandemic and the series of lockdowns happened while I was doing my research. So there were a whole bunch of archives that I meant to visit that I couldn't physically get to. That led to a whole bunch of time where I was just like having to politely harass already oversubscribed librarians into helping me track down obscure sources.
Blei Meza had scammed a lot of people out of a lot of money, and you were able to
Yeah.
talk to a lot of these people. How were you able to gain access and trust by these individuals?
I think a lot of it was luck. I was in like the right place at the right time. Like I would talk to someone in Ghana who would tell someone in London that I was doing this, and then I'd get like a mysterious phone call randomly. Once I was in a dance class and I saw that I had like a missed call, and I was like, this seems important. So I stepped out and it was someone like, I hear you're talking about Blei Meza. And it was just like, ah, my movie. That ended up being Peter Rigby, who is an incredible source and who trusted me with his story, which was remarkable, but also all the research he had done himself. All the material he had collected, like the wealth of knowledge he'd gained, like working with Blei Meza and traveling to Ghana over the years he was involved with the Omar and Ghana Trust Fund. I think he wanted there to be something written about Blei Meza and about everything that happened as a way to push, like, maybe the government of Ghana, maybe anybody else involved into looking into it again. because he truly believes that there was truth to what Blake Mazer was saying and that he will be vindicated and it was all right. There were lots of people who didn't want to speak to me either because they'd lost too much or they didn't want their current reputations being marred or affected by their involvement in the Omar Trust Fund. I also just had to be really, really patient and spend a lot of time getting to know people. And I tried to treat everyone with care and respect because even though it's like a romp and a scam, people's lives were like very, very connected to this. They found family, they found friends, they found sort of community. This was something for a lot of people that was going to change their lives and it was going to change the world. And for like a shining moment, it was this wonderful movement, and it changed people's lives in a way that like still reverberates today.
Yeah, that would be an interesting essay to write about the people who didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah, because everybody had very specific and very understandable reasons.
Yeah, because nobody wants to be scammed, right? Nobody wants to believe a lie.
No, and
Yeah.
nobody wants to look like an idiot. The truth of the matter is that people still believe the lie got written into history. Like, I'm not saying that people weren't also greedy, opportunistic, ignorant about Ghana, not very conversant with the way like finance works, but that's kind of beside the point because that's all of us. Like, nobody is beyond taking advantage of, and nobody is beyond scamming. It is a story that is incredibly believable and has been for decades.
Yeah, and in chapter one of your book, you write, Ghanaians love their con men. You named this book after Anansi, who
Yeah.
is a con man of Ghanaian lore. Can you tell me who Anansi is in a nutshell?
Anansi is like the classic trickster god, and his trick was like telling stories to get one over on someone. But the hitch would be that, like, once he was done with the scheme, and usually he'd fall flat on his face, and there'd be a lesson learned because these were like stories to teach children not to be tricksters. Sort of walk away from the scene, but whatever it is he conjured up, whether it was like a mountain or a crown or a kingship, it would still be there, like behind him in the distance. The story would outlive his little con, and that's what got me. That's what always gets you about trickster gods. There's always a truth in there somewhere.
At what point did you know you were done with your research?
I had a bit of a problem with research because I could not stop doing it. So I'd be trying to recreate what was happening in a room, and I'd be like, what did the room look like? Do we have pictures? Do we have accounts? Like, if it was a banquet room, what was the lighting like? What was the china like? What was the food like? And so I'd get into these really like detailed like research spirals. Every time I wrote, there'd be research questions. And so I ended up like researching stuff as I wrote. And then like all the processes that turn like a manuscript into a finished book also triggered their own little bits of research. Like, I'd have to go back and like check, double check, triple check, answer questions. And so I essentially was like basically looking stuff up until it went to press.
Well, this is your first book. What did you learn in your research and writing process that will help you in subsequent projects?
I learned to never do it in this way ever again. I will archive, categorize, digitize every bit of information I come across, even if it's like an urban legend somebody tells me when I'm randomly like out and about, I will write it down. I also just didn't fully appreciate how demanding the process was until I was like tired and unwell. And I was lucky to have had people to like lean on, give me advice, give me support, and I don't think I fully realized that. And like next time, I think I'll lean on them more heavily and realize like it's a very solitary process and it didn't need to be as lonely as it was sometimes, especially during the pandemic where I couldn't really go anywhere.
But in the end, the book comes out. It's a notable book on the New York Times 100 list for 2023. In 2024, you won the Plutarch Award, which is the top honor in the field of biography and is awarded by your peers. Previous winners include Jennifer Homans, Robert Caro, and Ruth Franklin, among so many others. What was your reaction on hearing that you won? And then also, how does it feel to come out of the gate as a first-time biographer to win such a prestigious award and to receive these accolades?
I was pretty stunned done to be in such a steam company. Because, like, even though it had been out for a bit, like, I still didn't fully view the book as like a thing that was outside me. And, like, in my brain, it was still like a Word document on my laptop. Yeah. So I was like, oh, other people read it? Not just other people who do this kind of work and understand how complex it is. And how hard it is to take all this information and render it in a way that is readable and engaging. I cannot stress how complicated it was to like take all this material of which I just collected too much and then have to discard a whole bunch of it to get to the point and to get to the story and to like form a narrative that was clear and had some movement. And so to be given an award by people who knew exactly what that process is like is humbling, but it's also just incredibly validating. Your work is seen, your work is understood, and you maybe succeeded in doing what you set out to do. Take something complicated and turn it into a good yarn, right?
That was Plutarch Award winner Yipoka Yibo talking with me on Zoom in February 2025 about her book, Anansi's Gold, The Man Who Looted the West, Outfoxed Washington, and Swindled the World, published in August 2023 by Bloomsbury. To nominate someone's biography for the Plutarch Award, visit our website, biographersinternational.org, and click on the Awards tab. I'm bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you so much for listening.